The great issues of life, whether they are personal or social, always hinge upon the concept of duty, what one ought to do in life. We know very well that the whole enterprise of mankind is a struggle of duty towards a particular end, and it makes no difference what position a person occupies in life, insofar as the broad question of duty is concerned. The division of duty may vary from person to person or from condition to condition, but that there is a duty of some sort or the other cannot be denied, because duty is another name for the function that one is expected to perform in the particular location of one's life. But what one ought to do cannot be decided easily unless another question is answered: what it is that one is aiming at. Your aim will decide to a large extent the nature of the expectations from you, whether in your individual capacity or in your capacity as a unit of human society. What is it that you seek finally? If this is clear to the mind, evidently what one ought to do also would be clear to one's mind. But neither of these questions is an easy one to answer. And without properly conceiving the very background of all our efforts in life, we seem to be going headlong every day, right from the morning till the evening, taking for granted that everything is clear to our minds. In fact, if there has been a proper clarity of thought in respect of one's duty and the aim of one's life, there would be no such thing as conflict in life. Conflict or disharmony arises among mankind due to the fact of missing the very purpose of life and consequently missing the nature of the functions that one is supposed to perform in life. Often we hear people saying, "This is my duty," or "This is not my duty." But on what grounds do you make these statements? How do you know that this is your duty and this is not your duty? Is it because you have been born in a particular family, that your father has been performing this function and therefore it is yours, and therefore also it is not yours? Or is there any other logical foundation for this concept of one's having this to do or not to do? We generally do not go deep into these questions. Mankind, unfortunately, is averse to go deep into any question. We like to float on the surface always in every kind of activity of ours. Whatever be the walk of life we live in, we seem to be content merely by swimming on the surface without going into the profundity of the issue on hand. But no problem is merely a surface issue. It is as wide as life itself. You can imagine how vast and how immense in magnitude is human life. And our concept of duty cannot be smaller than that. There is something in us which is vitally connected with everyone else. But for this fact, there would not be an endeavor to talk in terms of mankind, for instance. It is very strange, isn't it, that we speak of mankind as if there is some sort of a relationship between oneself and another in the group that we call humanity. The desire to form organizations, institutions, bodies, etc., whether in a small unit of a family or a larger one like the nation, a community, or an international organization, whatever be the concept of the body that you form, the hidden desire seems to be to form a harmonious whole out of the little ingredients we call human individuals. This desire is enough to indicate that there is some sort of a purpose we are aiming at in life. I am aiming at an organization. This is one's kind of aim that one can have in one's mind. Now, an organization is a general term. It can apply to any kind of people coming together. If two people come together and harmoniously work, it is an organization. If it is more than two, it can be 1,000, it is an organization. And if the whole of humanity is taken together as a single body, that too is an organization. Well, whatever it is, the point is that we seem to be discontented merely by isolated life that we may be compelled to live. An individual is not always happy by being absolutely cut off from human society. There is an instinct inborn in our nature to come together with other people. You call it a social instinct, without understanding what this instinct means. We just give a name, an instinct. But an instinct is an intelligent seeking on our part for the purpose of the achievement of a goal. An instinct is not a blind, chaotic urge that arises in ourselves. It is a very rational, purposive movement which is unintelligibly conducting itself towards a particular aim. And when we cannot understand the rational background of this instinct for social life, we call it irrational. But when we can understand the purposive movement of this instinct, it becomes logic. And there is no distinction between these two definitions, logic and instinct. One is rationally analyzable, the other one is incapable of such rationalization. Why is it that we have this instinct for social life? Why do we wish to come together and form bodies, whether it is a business body or a political body or a social body or a religious body or whatever that body be? We have some understandable and inscrutable feeling within us. From a part of ourselves, we may say, which speaks its own language. There are depths in our personality which are deeper than our conscious level, as we all know very well. This instinct I am speaking of, the instinct for social collaboration, does not necessarily arise from a conscious, deliberative thinking of the human individual. It is automatic. You feel. Many people say, "I feel." But this feeling arises not from your conscious level. It is not a logically deduced or a conclusion arrived at by induction or deduction, not by logically. It is a feeling which has a reason of its own, which transcends ordinary organizational thinking in logical terms. We have an aim to come together. Now, this necessity to come together, work together, implies that we seek a common purpose. Otherwise, there will be no point in coming together. If each individual flies at a tangent and there is absolutely no connection between the aim of myself and yourself, for instance, there will be absolutely no meaning in our joining together, coming together, meeting together, or forming a body or an organization. It is taken for granted, it is implied, that every organization of human society, of whatever nature, has an implication behind it that there is a common purpose behind human individuals. Otherwise, they would not sit together, speak together the same language. Now, stretching this argument to a little further, we are very fond of speaking in terms of mankind these days, humanity, for instance. We would be very happy if there are no wars, no battles, no quarrels, if there is a single government for the whole world, this is a great aspiration, no doubt. But how does this aspiration arise? Unless the whole of mankind has a single purpose or aim before it. If every individual is differentiated from every other, there cannot be such an aspiration at all. That you seek such a possibility, whether it is immediately practicable or not, is itself an indication of what humanity is basically made of. It is substantially one. But for the fact of this substantial unity of the building bricks of mankind, there would be no such thing as talk of universal government, etc. Even this idea will not arise in your mind. You know very well that the effect cannot contain what is not in the cause. The idea of universal government or single mankind and a humanitarian solidarity, etc., which arises as a kind of effect, a psychological product from our mind, has a cause behind it. If you are a logical thinker, you would naturally accept that there cannot be an effect without a cause. The very functioning of the human mind in terms of universal collaboration and achievement is an indication that it is based on some cause which is characterized by similar purposes. So, our concept of duty in life is naturally dependent on the aim that we have before ourselves. And as I try to explain in a few words, the final aim of mankind does not seem to be segregated internally, a fact that comes to high relief merely on account of our basic aspirations. We feel happy if we see our own brothers. There is a feeling between man and man. It is a common feeling, no doubt, arising on account of kinship of character and sympathy of feeling and unity of purpose. If this had not been there, there would be no such thing as mankind, humanity, etc., psychologically. So if the aim seems to be an organizational unity, a thing that automatically comes out as a consequence of our ways of thinking, our duties also cannot be of a dissimilar character. If there is a purposive collaboration of the aims of life among mankind, tending towards an organic perfection in itself, there cannot be a different set of ideals before the duties of mankind, because duties or functions are nothing but activities directed towards the achievement of the purpose of humanity. So we have already decided what sort of aim humanity seems to have, and now it is not so difficult to understand what duties we have before ourselves. The duties are as much related one to the other as the segments of the different aspirations of individuals are in respect of the total purpose of mankind. Now, I mentioned to you that there cannot be an effect without a cause. And a cause is implied logically behind the manifestation of an effect. This effect that we are speaking of today seems to be so large that the cause should be at least as large as that. We have a single humanitarian psychology before us. Man's mind working in its generality. It is not my mind or your mind that is working, but the mind of mankind as a whole, aiming at human perfection, mankind's solidarity, and a peaceful existence. This is the way in which the total mind of mankind works. As an effect of a cause which is prior naturally to this effect of total thinking of mankind. You may have a doubt in your mind as to whether it is true that we all think alike. Yes, we are not always thinking alike. Each individual has a world within his own or her own hat, as they say. But this is only an apparent diversity that we see when we are brought deep into the levels of our basic aspirations and likes. We will realize that these differences vanish. I give you a concrete example. You are a patriot and a lover of your nation, and there are millions of people inhabiting a nation, forming a nation, each individual having his own, her own ideas and whims and fancies, ideas and ideologies. Suppose a war breaks out and the whole nation is threatened by a war situation. You can imagine how the whole of the individuals join together, gird up their loins and aim at a single purpose. The isolated whims and fancies vanish at once. This can be very easily proved by a little bit of deep thinking. When a common purpose is before you, the individual idiosyncrasies go to the background. The individual whims and fancies come to the forefront only when the basic security is granted, not otherwise. If your life itself is going to be threatened, if the whole mankind is to be threatened by a catastrophe, you will see how mankind joins together for that single purpose. There would be no man-woman distinction. There would be no distinction of adult and adolescent and child. There would be no distinction of east, west, north, south, black, white, etc. We will all stand up vigilant, wakeful, to face this threat that is endangering mankind as a whole. This has been seen through the passage of history, and we can see it at any time, and even physically encountering such a danger, we can psychologically envisage such a possibility and see that at depths we are calm. We seem to be isolated only when the basic necessities are supplied to us, not otherwise. If the basic roots are shaken, then our different ideologies on the surface vanish altogether. So all this is a little bit of thinking along logical lines for the purpose of coming to a conclusion as to the duties of mankind based on the aims of or purposes of humanity. Unless there is some kind of connecting link lying at the background of human thought would not function in this manner. There cannot be any such thing as international thinking, for instance, unless there is a foundation for such a possibility. You know very well that diversities imply a kind of unity. Even two minds cannot communicate with each other unless there is a corresponding medium between the two minds. If one mind is cut off from another mind absolutely by a totally dissimilar character, one mind cannot communicate with another mind. There would be no such thing as any kind of congress between one person and another person. But we communicate our thoughts. We speak language which can be communicated to another. We understand each other. The very fact that we are able to understand each other implies that we can psychologically come together. This again implies secondarily that this understanding or thinking or communication of thought between one and the other is an external indication of a basic unity between the two persons. Otherwise, logic is a futile attempt. There will be no such thing as the concept of two unless there is the concept of the one already behind. You cannot imagine that there are two things in front of you unless you are able to synthesize these two things in your consciousness. So taking this to the larger dimension of humanity or mankind as a whole, we seem to be floating on the ocean of a single mind. You may call it, for our present purposes, the mind of mankind, the total mind of humanity, of which the individual minds are like drops. This total mind seems to be urging us forward for the realization of a purpose. Now, with this little introduction, I hope to come to the subject upon which I have been asked to speak during these few days, namely the message of some of the Upanishads, the great legacy, especially of our country, and a legacy not merely of this country, but of mankind as a whole, I should say. Upanishads, which are the record of thoughts of superhuman thinkers. I should not call them Indian thinkers. They were those who had risen above the level of ordinary mankind and thought non-human or superhuman thoughts. Such are the Upanishads. It is these Upanishads that will guide us in answering all these questions which I raised at the very beginning at this moment. We cannot independently walk with the strength of our own legs in this arduous task of solving universal questions or problems. These Upanishads, among whom we are to take up one or two for the purpose of the analysis of the subject, are, as I mentioned, records left by people who had, by the power of their meditations, risen above the ordinary level of human thinking. They could plumb into the depths of this total mind about which I made reference just now. For us, the total mind of mankind is only a theory. It is only a logically deduced abstract something. We are inferring that there should be a total mind on the ground that mankind seems to be moving towards the realization of a common purpose. But these masters were not merely theoretical arguers. They were those who thought in terms of that single mind only. Just as I think through my mind and you think through your mind, anyone thinks through anyone's mind, these great masters were able to think through this total mind, so that their thoughts were not individual thoughts. They were thoughts of all people blended together in an amalgam of completeness. These are the Upanishadic thoughts. Why we feel like taking the aid of these thoughts of the Upanishadic masters in answer of these questions is that they have gone to the very deep roots of the cause of all causes of these effects, manifesting themselves as this world, this society, this mankind, these efforts of mankind, etc., etc. We speak of human life, human duties, and human purposes, etc., without properly paying sufficient heed to the conditioning factors behind these thoughts of mankind. Our minds work in a particular fashion, being conditioned by certain factors. Now we gradually move to a philosophical realm from the ordinary social and empirical level of thought on which we have been moving up to this time. Philosophy is a study of causes, rather ultimate causes, and an explanation of everything in terms of these causes. Sometimes they call it metaphysical thinking. Whatever be the name you give to it, it is a study of ultimate causes and an explanation of everything through these. Now the ultimate causes should be such that there should not be causes behind these causes, else they would not be ultimate causes. The meaning of an ultimate cause is that it stands by its own right and it does not need to be explained by another cause precedent to it or prior to it. If every cause has a cause behind it, naturally there should be a final cause which is an explanation of every other cause. Otherwise, we would be landing in what they call an infinite regress, causes behind causes, causes behind causes, without coming to any kind of decision whatsoever. But you know very well that our minds are averse to any kind of infinite regress. We do not like chaotic thinking. We always like perfection and conclusion. And conclusion arrived at forever. Now this would not be possible unless there is an ultimate cause of all causes, a causeless cause. This causeless cause, you call the final cause or ultimate cause, should be capable of containing within itself every effect. Now, before we try to understand the nature of this cause, which is ultimate, we are also to have some idea of the effects which are contained in this cause. The effects are anything that we are capable of thinking, anything that we confront in our life. The whole objective universe is the effect. Why do you call it an effect, you may ask me? Because the universe has a tendency to move forward by process or progress of evolution. You have never seen one atom in this world lying static without movement. There is a motion of everything towards something of which there is no proper idea at the present moment. Rivers are flowing, the sun and the moon and the stars are active, we are more active, the whole world is very busy with doing something, and the astronomical world and the subatomic world are all very active, moving vibrantly, all seem to be immensely engaged in some purpose which they have not yet fulfilled. If the purpose has been fulfilled, there will be no activity afterwards. The very fact that everything in nature seems to be busily engaged in doing something is enough indication that it is aiming at a purpose. This is the characteristic of an effect. An effect is that which is aiming at something which is transcendent to its own nature. There is an effort on the part of everyone to transcend oneself, to become better, to grow larger in dimension, to become better quantitatively as well as qualitatively. This is what they call the urge for evolution, whether it is physical evolution, biological evolution or psychological. So, from this point of view, we can very easily conclude that the whole universe is in the position of an effect. It is not an ultimate cause. Because if it had been an ultimate cause, there would be no tendency to move or transcend. There would be no such thing as an urge to move forward, to outgrow oneself. Everything in the world seems to have a tendency to outgrow itself, to become better and grow larger. This is why we say the whole universe is effect in its nature and not a cause. So it tends towards a cause, and its activity ceases when there is what they call the realization of the cause or the purpose of existence. The whole universe is moving towards the realization of its purpose. This is cosmic evolution, which takes place in different levels of its manifestation. The lowest level of the universe is physical, material, and there is material evolution. The higher one is biological evolution. We grow and become better. There is psychological growth, there is mental evolution, there is intellectual growth, and so on and so forth. So the whole world conceived in any of its levels seems to be restlessly urging itself forward for the realization of a purpose. What this purpose is the subject of the Upanishads. We take for our discussion two of the important Upanishads because they are related to each other and they are cognate in their content. the one emphasizing one aspect of the matter, the other emphasizing other aspect. These are the Aitareya and the Taittiriya Upanishads. They are like brothers. They speak the same thing, but from two different points of view. They try to answer the questions of life by reference to causes. This is a very proper attitude, no doubt. You know very well, every question, when it is attempted to be answered, is referred to a cause. Why has this question arisen? Why is this disease here? Why is a person sick? We put questions of this kind, implying thereby we want to find out the cause of a present situation. If one is sick, we must find out the reason behind the sickness. If there is a war, you must find out the cause behind this war. If there is some kind of discrepancy, you must know the cause behind the discrepancy. If there is any kind of tension, you must know why this tension has arisen. Unless you know the cause of a particular circumstance, you cannot probe into the context of the circumstance. Whatever be the nature of this situation, whether it is a social one or a physical or biological, psychological or medical. So, this is a philosophical attitude that we are adopting towards everything in life. We are philosophers basically. There is no one who is not a philosopher. In the sense that everyone wants to know the cause of a particular effect. And this is nothing but the philosophical attitude. These great masters of the Upanishads went gradually moving from the lower causes to the higher causes until they were able to grasp with their own hands the final cause of things, and they gave out their conclusions as the final panacea for the ills of mankind. The ills of mankind are peculiar in their nature, and they are the causes of so many other illnesses to which we are heir. All the unhappiness of mankind is what we may call by a single term, the illness of mankind. The sorrow of mankind is the disease of mankind. We are sorry, we are unhappy, we are not satisfied. That is all. This is our present situation. This is our illness. Anything that puts you out of the gear and does not keep you in ease is disease. In absence of ease is called disease. And in that sense, the whole world is diseased. It is not in ease, it is restless. Even an atom is diseased. That's why it is moving. So by the process of deep yoga meditation, in which the great masters of yore engaged themselves, they plumbed the depths of reality, the ultimate cause. And for our benefit, they gave us the records of these experiences, the Upanishads. The way in which we can encounter reality is twofold. Inductive or deductive, as the students of logic will tell you. If you move from particulars to generals, you call this process inductive reasoning. But if it is a movement from generals to particulars, you call it deduction. Both ways are permissible according to the nature of the case. Every day the sun rises in the east. We have been seeing the sun rising in the east for days and days and months and years. So we collect all these particular instances of the sun rising in the east every day. And then we make a general conclusion, the sun always rises in the east. But there is a flaw in inductive reasoning, that your conclusions may not be correct. Why? Maybe for thousands and thousands of years the sun has been rising in the east, and therefore you are coming to the conclusion that the sun shall in future also rise in the east only. But it is not a valid conclusion because the sun is not bound by your conclusions. He may change his position for some reason or the other. What makes him rise in the east? Not your logic. It is something else. Some law that operates in the universe. That law can adjust itself in a different manner. Tomorrow he may rise in the west. So inductive reasoning is not an ultimately valid form of reasoning. From particulars we may go to generals. It is practically useful as far as things go, but not ultimately valid. The deductive reasoning is the other way around. You come from generals to particulars. For example, all men are mortal is a general conclusion. You know very well, everyone is mortal. Socrates is a man, and therefore Socrates is mortal. From generals we have come to particulars. From the general concept of all humanity being mortal, you have come to the conclusion that Socrates also must be mortal, because he is also a man. So this is to give you an idea as to what inductive reasoning is or deductive reasoning is. Philosophy is mostly inductive these days, especially from the point of view of Western thought. Western thinkers and philosophers have been very much wedded to inductive ways of thinking. They cannot suddenly jump to generals, inasmuch as there has been a great controversy as to the nature of generals or universals. We are not going to enter into this subject because our purpose is different. Our masters of the Upanishads, the great seers of yore, had a direct experience, and this experience is the general conclusion from which we can draw particular consequences in a deductive fashion these days. When we study these two Upanishads, the Aitareya and the Taittiriya, we shall follow mostly the deductive process of reasoning. That means to say, we shall follow the trend of thought of the Upanishads. It is deductive in the sense that the ultimate conclusion has already been given to us by the Upanishad. The nature of the cause need not be investigated by us with the sweat of our brow by inductive reasoning. Though we can try that method also, but for the present moment it is not necessary. The Upanishads have come to the final conclusion of the ultimate generality of truth, and that is the Upanishadic declaration. And this declaration is a definition of the ultimate nature of reality or the ultimate cause about which we have been speaking a few minutes before. The ultimate cause is the determining factor of every effect. The whole of this world, the whole universe is an effect of that ultimate cause. Now, we have already noticed that the ultimate cause cannot have another cause behind it. If that were the case, that cannot be called the ultimate cause, because that would be an effect of another cause altogether. We have also to be clear that there cannot be two ultimate causes, because then there would arise the difficulty of understanding or conceiving the relationship between these two causes. What is the connection of this ultimate cause and that ultimate cause, if there are two ultimate causes or more than one ultimate cause? You cannot conceive relation. The concept of relation is the most difficult thing to imagine in the mind. You cannot understand how one thing is related to another thing. You see, as I mentioned to you earlier, the very fact of our ability to communicate our thoughts among ourselves is an indication of there being a total mind behind ourselves. Otherwise, there would be no such thing as communication at all. Likewise, the imagination or conception that there can be two ultimate causes would imply that there is something connecting these two causes, transcendent to these two causes, which then would become the ultimate cause. So, somehow or other, the ultimate cannot be more than one. And there cannot be a cause behind it also.
So now you have got some idea as to what an ultimate cause can be. There cannot be something behind it, something prior to it, something larger than it or greater than it, and there cannot be something equal to it also. So such is the unique character of the ultimate reality. This is the cause. We call it reality because it does not seek anything further than itself. It has no aim or purpose beyond itself. It does not seek a self-transcendence of itself. So it is ultimate. It is the cause because everything proceeds from that. It is reality because it does not have anything beyond it. So the ultimate cause and ultimate reality mean one and the same thing. This existed, this exists, and this shall exist always. There cannot be anything more than this or second to it.